For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
People made split-second decisions without knowing or understanding the architecture of the hotel. So when the heavy firing began, some people ran up back staircase and some people ran down. And the difference between up and down can be life and death.
This is the Vice podcast. I'm Ben Anderson. I'm interviewing Adrian Levy and Cathy Scott Clark, whose fifth book is called The Siege, about the siege of the Taj Mahal Palace Hotel, which happened almost 5 years ago to this day. So most people probably remember roughly, very roughly, what happened. Take us through what actually happened now, having done your research.
Well, 5 years ago, pretty much to the day, a group of 10 Pakistani gunmen came over by rubber dinghy from Karachi to Mumbai with the view to setting the fourth largest city in the world alight, and they managed to cause total chaos, kill 166 people and hold several target locations, including the Taj Hotel, under siege for 3 days.
And 10 guys in a rubber dinghy doesn't sound like much, yet it lasted for, what, 3 days?
They had many simple and high-tech, low-cost ideas to make the plot really take hold. They had a control room back in Karachi with a bank of TV screens. They were tuned into all of the world's cable channels, well, CNN, BBC, local channels, AjTalk, Times Now, and they had broadband connection and Google Earth, and they had set up an internet telephony service like Skype. So the guys who were on the ground, the gunmen, were being directed using Skype free phone calls, using Google Earth. They'd never been in Mumbai before. And they could actually pick up the reactions to every action that they committed. So if they said to the guys on the ground in Mumbai, set fire to a hotel, the control room would then look at the pictures coming from BBC and say, the hotel's not burning. Work harder, make the hotel burn. So there was this ventriloquism. That was a new feature of the attack.
And I think also, although the kids, because they pretty much were kids, I mean, the average age of the gunman was 21. Although they were very ill-educated, they came from very impoverished parts of the Punjab in Pakistan. They had been through a very rigorous training program organized by Lashkar-e-Toiba, which was the Islamist group which planned and executed this attack. They'd spent about a year in jungle training camps, in mountaintop training camps, learning all sorts of very sophisticated warfare tactics. And they were very well armed.
Very well drilled. I mean, and it shows you a couple of simple ideas. They took small remote bombs with them. They placed them on taxis, and the bombs detonated all over the city at different times. And so the footprint for the attack appeared to be far larger than it was. And there was a time when the police were first mobilising, when we've got nearly all of their intercoms, so we can hear, you know, what they were saying during the night. Where they believed that an entire army had attacked the city rather than just 10 men with a plan being remotely manipulated from Karachi.
Well, even when you said 10 kids, I thought, 10? I remember it was much more than that, because it did feel like the whole city was being invaded at the time.
Yeah, no, it was 10 gunmen for the whole city, and they kept it going for 3 days.
But social media was used as well. This is a really interesting thing. Our passion, and the Indian passion for mobile phones, for texting, for Facebook, whatever it is, everything that could be used as social media was being studied by the controllers, the terrorist controllers in Karachi. So if a British guy was texting or tweeting his location in the hotel, that information, as it was channeled by news organisations, would be passed to the terrorists on the ground, who'd be told to go to that part of the hotel and find whoever it was. And in one case, a millionaire yacht broker took up a live interview with a British anchor working for BBC and revealed where all the people were hiding around him. Next thing you know, the gunmen are directed to that spot, the controllers watching the BBC, and that spot comes under siege, sustained fire with AK-47s, grenades thrown, and he would subsequently die.
Like how many people were, that they were in a room somewhere?
Hundreds.
And this guy revealed their identity. And how many gunmen were in the hotel?
Four gunmen in the hotel using mobile phones. And they'd receive a call, let's say, 3 o'clock in the morning. Just watch the BBC. All the people you're chasing are hiding on the club floor of the Taj. Find the club floor, go there now.
I think the important thing to say about the Taj, because it seems slightly unbelievable that four gunmen could keep a whole hotel full of 2,000 people sort of at bay, but what they were aided by in the first place was surveillance, video, maps, detailed plans of the hotel,
which GPS all, coordinates,
all been provided by this American, what would you describe
him as? Double agent
who was working for Lashkar e Toiba in the 2 years up until the Mumbai attacks, and he'd stayed at the hotel, he'd drunk in the bar, he'd gone on the Friday tour, which is when the members of the public were allowed to look around some of the back rooms. So although these boys from the Punjab had never left Pakistan before, they knew exactly their way around the hotel because they had been provided with all this material. So for the hotel staff and the police standing outside kind of not sure what to do, it just seemed like they kind of had this x-ray vision.
But also, if you just take it back one step, the hotel itself is a labyrinth. It's a hotel that came into being around 1901, 1902, and then it was remodeled, revised, transformed over the years. And it began as a hotel for the British upper classes, the colonial masters, and then it became a hotel for the Indian ruling classes, Indian Maharajas, Indian political stars, cricket stars, film stars, pop idols. And each time the hotel would be remodeled, another floor would be added or another entrance point, none of them met up properly. And so to actually work out the logistics of the hotel is extremely difficult for an ordinary person. When you walk in, going from north to south is a complex affair. There's the front of house, there's the backstage area where the chefs and all of the wait staff are working. And there were no blueprints. So extremely difficult to navigate as a guest, almost impossible for the security forces when they would eventually arrive. Extremely difficult for the police when the police turn up at the hotel. But the terrorists had a walkthrough using reconnaissance video. So they were probably more familiar with the hotel than many others who would come after.
I mean, there was even a 3D walkthrough that the Taj group had paid for on Google Earth, which was up on the net. So you could kind of wander around the environments of the hotel itself, around the back streets and work all the ways in, ways out, and they used that as well. The terrorists got
running live that night. So one of the guys who they had in the control room was from Mumbai originally. He's from Maharashtra originally, not from Mumbai, but the state around the city of Mumbai. And he was familiar with everything to do with the city. And he was sat at his desk in the control room in a secure area near to Karachi Airport, looking at Google Maps, walking around the 3D spin around, the point of view that provided for Google by the Taj, so that they could navigate when people didn't know where they were going.
And so Google Maps, 3D maps, Skype, Twitter, live news interviews, do you think this is a template for attacks that we'll see more of?
Definitely. It's a swarm. The whole idea of the swarm, the idea that, you know, a small number of well-articulate, you know, well-trained, well-drilled men can go into a densely packed city and attack wide-open civilian targets. And you'll know that it was exactly copied in Nairobi in the Westgate Mall attack that's just recently happened this year. And the supervisors, the masterminds for that attack, were trained in Pakistan by the same team that drilled Mumbai 26/11. The lessons that were learnt from Mumbai were enhanced and smoothed and polished for the Westgate Mall attack. But they're basically the same genesis. And remember, the operation in Mumbai, it cost around $40,000. So it's low cost, high tech, you know, internet telephony. Even their phone bills were kept small with, you know, Skype-like lease line contracts.
I was going to say, it's high tech, but cheap.
Cheap.
I mean, stuff which you can access for free.
Yes.
And we always hear that Al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups are these multi-billion dollar international criminal mastermind networks, but this sounds, I mean, in some ways amazing.
Inventive.
But in some ways quite simple and quite easy set up.
Yes, and I think it's the way forward that they'll do it again. I mean, it's such an easy thing to do. If you do your homework and you've got your maps and you've sorted out your communications, what's easier than to walk into a shopping centre or a five-star hotel and cause chaos with a few AK-47s? And you get on the headlines, you get on the news straight away. You get what you want, which is publicity, which brings in with it funding and more recruits.
Yeah, I think it represents definitely a new kind of exportable model. And, no city is prepared for that kind of terror. It doesn't matter whether it's in the US, the UK, across Europe. We're not prepared for it. I mean, you know yourself, if you walk into a mall, you might see one security guy on the door. What's he going to do in the face of an AK-47 charging him down? He's not going to hang around.
If the attackers are prepared to die.
And they're prepared to give up their life. They're all Fidayeen squads. They're all suicide squads, charged up. They've been honed. I mean, the boys, we studied the team that went into Mumbai, went to see their families in the Pakistan Punjab, and went to the training areas and the training camps. And the process was brilliantly, brilliantly put together. You know, they arrive off the bus. They immediately give up their names and they're given a number. They're housed in these massive barrack-like tents. And the first thing that happens is religious transformation. And they're all basically made the same through a series of very intense religious and physical training. And they get an incredible internal discipline. They get to belong as a group. And then they work them using similar methods to the special forces in the West. You know, they train them in extreme cold, in extreme heat at day and at night. Non-verbal communication. I mean, it really is an intense period, which is well calculated, with a lot of psychology involved. And we describe it as making them childlike, infantilizing them.
It sounds a bit like boot camp.
It's boot camp.
Break them down and then build them up into something else.
I think the other important thing to say is that they choose their recruits really carefully.
Yeah.
So they'll go to very impoverished areas where there are no jobs, where quite often the fathers are absent because they're working in Dubai because there's no way of making money where they live in Pakistan. And they'll choose boys from big families who are missing their father figure and who don't really have a kind of a close family unit around them. And they'll take them away and they'll drive into the villages in their big sort of pickups with AK-47s flashed around, and they'll just say, who wants to come with us? And which kid in that village is not going to want to go with them rather than going off to the fields and earning like 200 rupees for 3 days' work, starting at 4 o'clock in the morning? It's much more exciting to go off and do something like this. To be part of something, to have some respect, to have some kind of excitement. I mean, you'll see the posters in all these villages of the martyrs who've gone before, and they are like kind of Hollywood heroes. And kids are indoctrinated and trained to want to sign up to groups like Lashkar-e-Toiba because it provides a possibility to become something, to break out of the mundaneness of your daily life.
You see graffiti along the way that says in the Punjab, that says not cricket star, not movie star, but jihad star. And they've got a character called Jihad Joe, who's like a cartoon figure, who's passed around schools, showing, you know, what can happen if you actually want to go the hero's path rather than going the poor agricultural worker's path. And, you know, that's why so many boys get swept up along with organisations like Lashkar.
And you say Punjab, where exactly were the training camps?
They've got two areas to train. The recruiting grounds are in the Punjab, but not the training areas, because the Punjab is densely populated and easy to access for unwanted observers. And so they train in the mountains in Kashmir, in Pakistan-administered Kashmir, above the capital of that state called Muzaffarabad. And there in the Chelabandi Hills, they've got an enormous complex, brilliantly organised, with a technical nerve centre that was known as the Ice Box. And inside there, they had every kind of quickening, new-aided technology that you would have pretty much anywhere else, you know, with a good broadband connection. And they had three parade grounds and drilling grounds, which are named after great Islamic battles. And then above that, further up into the mountains, there's all kinds of more sophisticated honing that goes on, and training involving survival and nighttime manoeuvring, manoeuvring in snow, climbing. They've got all sorts of different units with different physical capabilities.
But in the case of the boys who was destined for Mumbai, of which were 32 original recruits, their final graduation was to go off into the mountains for 3 days and three nights without anything, and to be chased by their trainers and those with live fire. And those that survived would then graduate by being given a live goat, a knife, and a matchbox with which to then have kind of like hilltop feast.
Slaughter the goat, cook it themselves, and the people who graduated from that would then sit in the dinghy and take off from Karachi for Mumbai.
So it sounds like the kind of very advanced training camp that we were told existed in Afghanistan, but didn't really, but does in Pakistan.
Yeah, Lashkar are backed by the intelligence service in Pakistan. They were conceived by the intelligence service in 1991. And the idea was there would be a covert army that would fight India under the cover, particularly in divided Kashmir, where they began waging war. And they would do it in plain clothes, but their munitions, their money. And initially, their training was provided by the Pakistan military and Pakistan intelligence. And in this plot for 2611, all around the plot are individuals from the intelligence service and the military. Maybe not the institutions, but individuals who act as his liaison, who refined the training, particularly when it became a marine operation, going at night in a boat with landlocked boys who'd never been on the sea before, that required input from specialists to give them that edge.
So with support of rogue agents from the state, or with support from the state?
Well, that's something that it's very difficult to establish. I mean, there were at least four agents from the Army and all the ISI who were actively involved in this operation. There was one handler who was an ISI major who was based in Lahore, who worked with David Headley, who was the American scout, the one who did all the surveillance. And then there was a Major Sahib who the one surviving terrorist described as coming to the jungle camps several times to check whether the training was going well and how the boys were doing. And he was an army officer. He might well also have been ISI. And then, as Adrian said, there was an army frogman who took the recruits through all they needed to learn for the training to go across the sea. And then, I mean, the camps that they were trained in were the same camps, as you say, that the Mujahideen had trained in Afghanistan. They're the same locations, and they were set up by the ISI with training and munitions provided by the army. So, I mean, there's still a very close connection. Whether or not the ISI as an organisation was actively involved in Mumbai,
it's not provable one way or the other, but there's a very close link. I mean, when you talk to investigators in Pakistan who work in the civilian side, if you ask them about Lashkar, they describe Lashkar to you as the foreign policy tool of the spies in Pakistan. They cannot see any difference between Lashkar internally, the internal debate inside government and the military. Lashkar and the spies, they're the same organisation. So for them, they raise the issue that it's impossible to understand how an operation like that could happen unless there was some kind of institutional backing. But there's no evidence of it. They're very good at what they do.
And what's been the US response to this? Because obviously Pakistan, as a US ally, gets 1.6 billion, whatever it is, in aid every year. Yet someone from the state is sponsoring terrorist groups.
America's role in this operation is quite a complicated one, because they were actually running the same guy who did the scouting for Lashkar-e-Toiba was also working for the CIA, trying to infiltrate jihadi groups in Pakistan with a view to finding bin Laden, because this was obviously in 2008. And although they passed on 26 warnings to the Indian authorities between 2006 and just before the attack happened, they didn't identify the source of their information because they wanted to keep this guy in play to look for al-Qaeda leaders.
Yeah, I mean, as you know, with intelligence is a messy business. And here at the centre of this, there's a man who's serving many, many sides. This guy, David Headley, whose real name is Dawood Salim Jilani. He was born to a mother from Maryland and a father from Lahore, who fell in love in Washington while the Pakistani father was over working for Voice of America. And this unlikely love match gives rise to this hybrid who can survive in Lahore, and he can survive in the Upper West Side where he went to live in New York. And he could straddle both worlds, speaking the language of both worlds, and be accepted as two kinds of things. Come 1998, when al-Qaeda strikes against America in Africa, blowing up the embassies in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam, having dallied with different sides of an American life and also been a drug dealer and had a kind of quite a developed sense of self-preservation from dealing heroin on a massive scale, both in Pakistan and America, he offered himself up to the intelligence services with a deal that he get let off his most recent heroin offence, importing, I think over a kilo, or was it?
10.
10 kilos of smack. He get let off in order for him to penetrate the Islamist movement in Pakistan, starting with Lashkar-e-Toiba. And so the intelligence community can't think of a better offer at that time. They have no one else in who's got that proximity and who holds an American passport. So he begins, and slowly worming his way into the organisation, who are very suspicious of him to start with. And it won't really be until 2005, 2006, that he's fully embedded inside Lashkar, and he's accepted as a Lashkar cadre, I suppose you could say. And at the same time, he's filing information all the time back to the CIA, who are not fully in control of him. And so you've got this two-way rogue embedded agent of influence, an asset really, who's supplying information, working his own agenda, enriching himself. I mean, and another example of how bizarre the way this worked, his private life was equally surreal. He had three wives who didn't know of each other's existence. He married a makeup artist, a Canadian, living in New York, who believed that he was the one and only David Headley, knew nothing about his antecedents. At the same time, he had a conservative Islamic wife living in Lahore who thought she was the one, and she lived a very covered existence and had a very conservative religious relationship with Dawood Gilani. And then he found himself a third wife, a young Moroccan medical student who was Western-leaning, who knew nothing of the other two women, but who discovered on his mobile phone one day that he was dating, seeing, in fact, had children with two other wives, and blew up and started reporting to the authorities during the planning for the Mumbai operation. And in the midst of all of this, he's scouting Mumbai, taking videos, offering insights into the hotel, moving seamlessly around the city.
But he's one of the main characters of the book, and I think even people who followed this story minute by minute at the time have never heard of this guy. You say he's a double agent. When I think of a double agent, I think he's pretending to work for Russia, but he's actually working for America, or vice versa. He actually seems to be working for both at the same time.
Yeah, the CIA, the intelligence people call him a triple agent, in effect, because they say that he was working for the CIA, Lashkar, and himself. And that may be the most accurate description.
But he's not pretending to help Lashkar. He is actually helping Lashkar and helping to plan this attack.
Yeah.
He's helping both sides, yes. And the other bizarre thing about him is that virtually everybody in his family tried to warn the authorities. So his mum rang up the FBI, said, I'm worried that my son keeps disappearing off to Pakistan, coming back with a beard and talking about all this crazy Islamic shit. And then his wife in America, his Canadian makeup artist wife, rang up the FBI and said, he keeps going on about 9/11 and saying what great heroes the people who were flying the planes were, and I'm really worried about him. His Moroccan wife went to the American embassy in Islamabad in Pakistan twice and tried to report him, saying he keeps going off to Mumbai with some story about...
He's casing Mumbai.
...planning some operation there. He's pretending he's running a business over there, but he keeps coming back, and I'm sure he's planning some kind of terrorist operation. And his brother, his half-brother in America, who was in captain in the US Army based in Iraq, rang up his superior officer and said, I've got this really strange half-brother who's half-Pakistani, and he's just come to a family party and said he's had a son and he's calling him Azama. So all these people from his family were trying to warn the authorities that he was up to something really, really dodgy, and yet nothing was actually done about it. But to also go back to what you were saying about the American role in all of this, their role is complicated because of the relationship between America and Pakistan. So, for example, there was a big intelligence dossier was handed to the State Department in 2007 about Lashkar-e-Toiba, saying that they had it was by British and French security analysts, saying that they had evidence that Lashkar was planning to break away from its traditional field of fighting against India in Kashmir and was looking to mount some kind of big operation internationally targeting Americans, Brits and Israelis.
In London, possibly.
Using what they described as clean skins, i.e. white converts, to sort of do surveillance and potentially be involved in the operation as well. And this dossier of evidence was presented to the White House, and George Bush's government at the time said, well, that is an issue for Pakistan domestically to deal with, because Musharraf was still the president in Pakistan. Lashkar was still a government agency in Pakistan, so nothing was done about that. So they could have prevented Mumbai.
America's always been hobbled by its desire to court Pakistan. America wants to see Pakistan as its Islamic ally, standing up as a security bulwark against Al-Qaeda, against the Taliban, as you know, on the Afghan border, the hot border between Pakistan and Afghanistan, the hot border with Iran, the hot border with India. And yet the reality is that Pakistan, as often as not, does its own bidding, of course, and its interests do not meet the interests of America. And there's no clearer example of that than here. I mean, when the Lashkar dossier was delivered, the attitude of the George W. Bush administration was, we can't touch Lashkar. The military are too sensitive in Pakistan about Lashkar. They rejected it outright.
But even if there's an intelligence briefing saying that Western targets or Western individuals are going to be targeted, and there's this man is plotting something, you know, do some agencies get hold of that and then the CIA say, keep off him, he's our asset?
It must be the case, because so many people reported him so many times and yet nothing was done. And, you know, we know that he was the source of the intelligence that was then passed on to the Indians, warning them that an attack was imminent. 26 bulletins derived from David Headley, naming the city, naming the methodology, landing by boat at night, naming the type of attack, suicide attack,
the targets,
all the hotels named, the Taj, the five-star Oberoi, the train station that would be attacked called Victoria Terminus,
Jewish Centre.
So all of these components were passed in bulletins, but as it happened, the Indians didn't develop the intelligence.
But he was not pretending to plan this to get deeper into Lashkar. He was actually helping to plan this attack.
Both.
So he wasn't loyal to anyone.
No, he was loyal to himself.
And just whoever was paying him, that was it.
He's a
mercenary. He's a man who likes to be at the centre of attention. He likes to be in the middle of all the intrigue and excitement. He sees himself as a James Bond character.
He's the loudest guy in the bar. He's the guy who wore the Rolex Submariner and had the leather coat flung over his shoulder with a blonde ponytail. Striding into the bar, he wanted to be seen and heard.
Only drinking Dom Perignon champagne, nothing else.
But how can you trick the CIA? Because presumably, if you're looking to recruit people in your CIA, the main thing you've got to know is this guy trustworthy?
No, but it's messy. It's messy, isn't it?
It doesn't work like that.
And if they're looking for someone that can get them to Osama bin Laden, this is not going to be a straightforward character. It's going to be someone who's already very compromised. They're going to have to make more compromises to use someone like that. I mean, there are many occasions when they've done similar with other characters. I mean, someone who's going to join Al-Qaeda or fight for an Islamist group is not going to be a very straightforward person to deal with. And I think that someone like David Headley is the best you're going to get in terms of a genuine way in to an organisation.
And he'd been edging from this one group, Lashkar-e-Toiba, towards Al-Qaeda, and that's what became critical. He befriended one of Al-Qaeda's main military commanders called Ilyas Kashmiri, and this guy was operating up in the tribal areas of Pakistan. And as soon as that happened, and they were clearly friends, emailing each other, telephoning using code names, all of which were picked up by the intelligence service, it became clear that there was an American passport holder with an Americanized name who was nearer than anyone else at this time to Al-Qaeda, and not only to Al-Qaeda, but to one of the leading military commanders of Al-Qaeda.
But that's what he doesn't seem like he's brilliant at getting close to Al-Qaeda as a CIA asset. It seems like he was genuinely felt an affinity with Al-Qaeda. It felt like his political views were with Al-Qaeda.
Several family members and a couple of his wives said that when he was in America, he was American. He had American views. He was patriotic. And something clicked in his mind. And when he was in Pakistan, he was patriotic to Pakistan and to Islam. I mean, he had one blue eye. He still has. He's still alive. One blue eye, one brown eye. And it's completely separated in his head, these two sides of his personality. So he is loyal to both, and he is working for both. But ultimately, as Adrian says,
he's working for himself.
Yes.
And did he actually dangle that carrot in front of them? Like, I might be able to get you bin Laden, so give me a free pass.
Yes, he did that deal in 1998. It was cemented in 1999. Instead of receiving what the others in the drug syndicate he worked for at that time received, which was between 4 and 10 year sentences, he'd walked and was in Pakistan on a ticket paid for him by the US government within a year. And so this extraordinary man who could barter his way out of any situation. We've actually seen footage of him being interrogated by the FBI subsequently when eventually he was arrested for one reason or another. And he's absolutely winning the room. You know, he can sit in a room and he can play anyone in any way. Extremely.
He's not trained to do interrogations like the FBI or the CIA would be. He's his own wits.
Yeah, I mean, the only training he received actually was from the ISI, because one of the things they did was to get him inserted next to the ISI because he was close to Lashkar. And he admits that he was given a compressed one-year course in Lahore, which was run by a non-commissioned officer who took him through surveillance, counter-surveillance, communication methods, dead drops, which is the basic training course that an ISI officer would be given when they recruited the spy agency in Pakistan.
And where is he now?
He's incarcerated in a jail in America on a 35-year sentence. But, you know, considering the fact he was charged with the deaths of 166 people and the prosecutor suggested the death sentence might be appropriate, everyone can see the deal that he did that got him this lesser sentence. And I have no doubt he'll be in the witness protection program and out within a decade.
And did you try and get access to him in prison?
We are writing.
We're still working on that. Very difficult.
Yeah.
Because he's still an asset.
Yeah. Going back to the siege itself, there are some incredible stories of heroism from the people working and staying in the hotel. Can you describe some of them?
Yes, I mean, the one of the terrible things about that night is that the security forces in India didn't really respond. I mean, the police were told to stay out of the hotel and wait for the National Security Guard, which is their equivalent of kind of SAS, to come down, but they were in Delhi. And so inside the hotel were four gunmen and about 2,000 guests and staff. And it became clear within sort of 3 or 4 hours to the staff of the hotel that they were going to have to try and do something themselves because no one else was coming in. And so what they worked on was they could see that the gunman had an intricate knowledge of the front of house of the hotel. They prayed that the gunman didn't really know how the back of the hotel worked, so the kitchens, the corridors, the storerooms. And so they worked out, because most people had been mid-dinner when the attack started and people were hiding in restaurants, that they would use the kitchens out of the back of the restaurants to get people into the back of the hotel and then congregate them in one place and then try and get them out into a street behind. And they did very successfully get most of the guests into one location, but I think that was their failing, really, was because they took everyone into one location. As Adrian said, one of those guests then rang up and gave a live interview to the BBC and said, we're all in this private club called Chambers, which was actually not on the map of the hotel, not on the blueprint. That's when the gunman found this location and shot into the crowd of people that
killed
was in there.
Killed a lot of people.
And they killed mainly hotel staff, because the hotel staff were in the process of getting these people out down a staircase outside when the gunman came through the kitchens. And a group of chefs who were sort of shielding people and trying to get them out turned around, saw the gunman rushing into the kitchens, shooting, and ran at them and took the bullets, basically. And the guests and the diners who were behind them were saved.
But people made split-second decisions without knowing or understanding the architecture of the hotel. So when the heavy firing began, some people ran up back staircase and some people ran down. And the difference between up and down can be life and death. And the ones who ran down were running down into the darkened basement, and the gunman came after, hunting them room by room, and basically killed nearly everyone who was in the basement. One woman who was had been to the Taj to celebrate her brother's birthday, her 32nd birthday, they were having a slap-up Chinese dinner, and it's a very lovely Sichuan restaurant. She chose the down staircase along with her in-laws, her brother, all of their family. They were separated in a succession of rooms along a darkened corridor, and she could hear the gunman coming room by room, kicking the doors down, shooting everyone dead. And she herself was a Buddhist, and she began her own routine, chanting, taking herself into herself, meditating. And when they came for her, they knocked the door down in the darkness. They shot everyone in the room that she was in. She received 5 rounds. Nearly all her internal organs failed, apart from her heart. She lost a tremendous amount of blood. And she woke herself up on the gurney, finding herself in a hospital several hours later. Doctors could not believe that she'd come round. And somehow she'd managed to slow down her metabolism enough to be able to withstand the assault. And when she woke up, they then had to break the news that everyone she was with that night had been slaughtered. And other guys had done miraculous things. There was an American Marine captain who'd fought fighter missions in Iraq, flying a Harrier in the Fallujah operation. And he heard the gunshots coming up the staircase. He was remarkable.
He was fantastic, because he was having dinner. He was half Indian, and he hadn't been back to India for nearly a decade. So he'd gone back to Mumbai to meet all relatives, his long lost cousins and stuff. And they were all having dinner on the top floor of a tower, which is like the tower next to the hotel, it's part of the hotel. And he heard the shots, gunfire, realised immediately that something very bad was happening downstairs. And he ripped up all of his identification things in his purse, in his wallet. He stuffed his Stars and Stripes credit card down his sock. And then he proceeded to evacuate everyone in this restaurant and a ballroom next door, down 20 flights of a fire escape, got them all out completely safely, even though they had to go run this sort of gauntlet of a sniper's alley on one of the floors. And then he just walked out into the crowds and just walked away and didn't tell anyone what he'd done.
Without telling anybody who he was, what his experience was, never went to claim any glory for it. Just quite extraordinary. He built an eyrie for them before they did the evacuation, which was like a kind of military bastion, like a forward operating base, a FOB, inside the hotel. He had people up in the suspended roof ready to jump down in case the gunman came up through the lifts. They armed themselves inside the kitchen, apart from him, because he saw the knives, and he just kept thinking of AK-47s. And as he said to us, don't take a knife to a gunfight.
You spoke to him?
Yeah.
Eventually.
A lot of coaxing.
He was one of the most difficult interviews because he just didn't want to tell his story.
So you rescued dozens?
250 people, nearly.
And then just walked into the night and
yep.
Vanished.
Never told anyone what he'd done?
No.
And how did you hear about him?
Heard about him through staff at the hotel. The security staff at the hotel were also extraordinarily brave.
But also there was also a South African VIP security team in the same restaurant who had been talking about their story, and they'd mentioned that they'd had some help from a US Marine of Indian descent.
Without giving him away, yeah.
And we eventually worked out his name.
So the police were told to stand down and wait for the Indian Special Forces to come. How long did it take for them to arrive?
It took 12 hours in the end, because the Indian Special Forces, although they were highly trained and the perfect force to send into a hotel that was under siege, they were based in Delhi, so that's 3 hours already. They had to wait for the government of Maharashtra, which is the state that Mumbai is the capital of, to officially request assistance. Then they had to wait for permission from the Home Ministry, the Security Ministry, and then eventually, even though they'd rung up, the head of the NSG, National Security Guard, had rung up his superiors and said, 20 minutes after the operation started, we can get straight down and deploy to the airport now. He was not given the authority to go and do that until 1 o'clock in the morning. And then when they got to the airport, there was no plane. They eventually found a plane. The plane had no fuel. The plane had no crew. And then there was no lifting gear to take all their kit onto the plane. They had to hump it on by hand. And so they eventually turned up at 7 o'clock the next morning.
So 12 hours after the initial call?
Yes. And so they actually went into the hotel 12 hours after the initial call. By which stage, the gunmen, although they're young kids, had done exactly as they had been trained, which is to find a stronghold, take hostages, make sure you're bedded down, you've got people on all levels around you, and sit and fight it out to the death. So they were well embedded by that stage.
So the Special Forces, when they finally arrive, then what happens?
They then had to work out where the gunmen were, because the hotel was still full of people. Apart from the people who'd been evacuated by the American Marine Force captain and the South African VIP security team, who were all in the same location, everybody else was still inside. So there were upwards of 1,500 people. So the NSG couldn't just burst into the hotel and start shooting willy-nilly, because they would have shot loads of innocent people. So they had to work out exactly where the gunmen were. And the gunmen kept moving, and they kept moving with the hostages as well. So they'd go from one stronghold, they'd be in there for 5 hours, then they'd go to another one. And eventually, on the third day, the National Security Guard worked out that the gunmen were in a corner restaurant, which had a spiral staircase, which went from the bar, the harbour bar, the main bar of the hotel, up to the Japanese restaurant called Wasabi. And there was a pillar around this spiral staircase, which was completely reinforced. And so whatever they chucked at these two rooms, which the terrorists went up and down all the time, they just couldn't get in, they couldn't fire in, they couldn't actually destroy the concrete around the spiral staircase. So the way they ended it in the end was to, the NSG created these kind of like homemade bombs out of dynamite and RDX, and they wrapped some other stuff around it, and they basically chucked one into the top floor restaurant and chucked one into the bottom floor restaurant simultaneously, and they blew the whole thing up. And then they killed the four gunmen after 68 hours.
And how come the four gunmen were in there and no hostages?
Because by that stage, they'd set fire to so many bits of the hotel, they'd had to relocate several times, and they'd lost the hostages in the process, or they'd kill people as well. And it was just kind of them against the NSG at the end.
And I remember, I know he wasn't one of the four guys who was in the hotel, but I remember the one surviving attacker. He was interviewed on a hospital bed while he was under arrest.
Yeah.
And it seemed like he'd suddenly realised what he'd done.
Yes.
He seemed sort of like a child, and he said, "Oh my God, I'm so sorry." And it's almost like he'd woken up from a dream or something.
I think you characterised it exactly correctly. I mean, he got caught about 1 o'clock on the first morning, so this is about 4 hours after the whole operation had started. And he was driving up Marine Drive in the main kind of drag against the sea in Mumbai. And he came up against a big roadblock, police roadblock, and his accomplice got shot dead. And he kind of came out of the car firing. And three policemen jumped on him, two of whom died because they were shot in the stomach. And he was then taken off to this hospital and was interrogated immediately. And he just completely broke down and gave it all away within half an hour. He'd explained which group, the fact it was Pakistan, where they'd been trained, who they'd been trained by, the fact that ISI people had been helping to do the training, what were their targets, what was the plan, i.e. fight to the death. I mean, he gave it all up. And he... people said that he was playing a role, and that he wasn't really as contrite as he tried to show himself to be when he was lying on the bed, but I don't think he was sophisticated enough to be able to do it any other way. And he said, I basically had been given up by my family, and I'd gone into this and I'd realised 2 months into the training that I didn't want to do this, but by that stage it was too late and no one came to get me from my family, and I just got stuck in this programme of training and pushed into this suicide mission, and this was him on the bed was the first chance he'd had to actually say anything to anybody outside of Lashkar-e Toiba.
And you believe him when he says that?
Yeah, I do. I think he had been brainwashed. And suddenly he's in the mission. I mean, he was ruthless when he was in the train station, which is where he was sent. I mean, him and his accomplice killed more than 60 people in about 3 minutes, shooting dead like grannies, kids, anybody, everybody.
Just casually walking around on your machine gun.
Yes, and I think, but he'd been in that programme of training for more than a year by that stage, and he'd charged up, adrenaline firing on all cylinders into the situation of attacking Mumbai, went in, did his job, and then suddenly he's arrested and he's like, shit, what have I done? I mean, whether he felt contrite or not, who knows? I don't know, but we won't know because he was hung last year for his crimes.
I was going to say, the authorities didn't believe him.
No. Well, he did what he did. Whether he was programmed to do what he did, or whether he genuinely felt that he wanted to kill foreigners and Hindus and whatever, you don't know. I mean, he was just on that zone. Yeah.
I remember at the time we heard loads of stories about the Americans and the Brits who were caught up in the siege. But it seemed to me there were some incredible stories about the local people who lived and worked there and their heroism. Can you tell me some of those stories that are in the book?
Yeah, one of the most amazing stories comes from a young restaurant manager in the Taj called Amit Peshave, who we interviewed at length. And he was running the 24-hour coffee shop on the ground floor of the Taj, so which was just behind the lobby. So when the attackers, the two teams of two men came in one side door and through the lobby, he kind of heard it straight away because he was on duty in his restaurant, which had about 60 people in it. And he was just completely terrified. His head was filled with the fact that he was three staff down that day. He turned up late. There were problems in the kitchen. Something wasn't working. So his head was kind of full of all this stuff. And then suddenly gunmen come in through the lobby. A load of people in the lobby run into his restaurant, meaning there's now 80 people in the restaurant, and he's the only member of staff on duty. And he told us that he kind of thought, what the hell do I do here? Everyone's looking at me now thinking that I'm going to help them and rescue them. What do I do? And he remembered, because the gunmen were coming this way, that there was actually a door where the live band played that was never used, but the door opened up onto the gardens. And so he thought, if I can get that door open, then potentially we can get into the gardens and then out the back of the hotel. And so all the guests were sort of like under the tables, lying on the floor, and he went and charged at this door, which was still locked, opened it up, and he said he got outside and he just looked up at the stars and just thought, I can actually go now. I could just save myself. And he said he was like this close to doing it, and then he thought, I could never live with myself. The rest of my life I would always think that I've let these people behind me die. So he turned round and he said it was the worst moment of his life, because he turned around and he saw these sort of faces of people looking at him, and he just thought, we've got to stick together with them. I've got to stick together with them, and which he did. And he spent another 3 or 4 hours. He actually did get them out into the garden. They hid in this bush, big load of bushes beside the swimming pool for about 4 hours. And he then went back in several times into the hotel to go and find people. Like there was one couple who'd lost their six-year-old son had gone to the toilet and he was missing. So Amit tried to get back into the hotel to find him, nearly got shot, had a grenade thrown at him. I mean, he eventually got out with all of the people he'd rescued from the restaurant. And again, he just walked away. Well, he walked to the hospital, the main Bombay hospital, because he'd found out lots of his friends in the kitchens were also killed and shot. And so he then spent the rest of the 2-3 days in the hospital, helping the ambulance drivers with all the bodies and injured colleagues from the Taj. I mean, he was a great character.
And how many people did he save in the end?
40 people? No. There were 80 people in the restaurant to start with. He got 40 out through a fire escape and the other 40 went with him into the bushes. So 80 in total.
And what's he doing now? Is he back at the hotel?
No, he's in London. He's working for a company in London, completely different job. But I think he's still very kind of cut up about what happened, because I mean, it's a big terrible trauma to go through. I mean, he said one of the worst moments was that after he and the people in the restaurant got out into the bushes, which was overlooking the pool, he could see that there were still two tourists sitting at this poolside bar, and he'd actually served them a bottle of wine earlier on before it had all kicked off. And he said, for something, they were quite old, they were Canadian. Some reason they were still sitting at this table drinking their wine, even though this thing was all kicking off. And he said he watched one of the gunmen who'd already kind of come into his restaurant and shot dead one of his waiters. He watched his gunman walking out of the lobby down towards the pool area, and he could see that it was only a matter of seconds before the gunman would spot these people because there were some pillars in the way. And he thought, what do I do? I could like shout at them and tell them to get out of the way because they're going to get shot any minute now. Or I could keep quiet because I've now got like 30 people with me in the bushes. He said the worst thing he had to do was watch this gunman walk down, spot the two people there, shot them dead, point blank range. And he didn't do it, and Amit didn't do anything because he thought, I've got 30 people with me and there are only two. So he said that he's had nightmares about that ever since.
And it sounds like you've spoken to most of the people who were involved. What are their lives like now, 5 years on?
Depends what happened to them on the night. I mean, one of the people that we interviewed at length is London. He worked for a video company, and his name was Will Pike, and he was on holiday with his girlfriend, and they'd been in Goa for 2 weeks, and they'd had decided at the last minute to have one splurge, one night at the Taj, bit of luxury, fluffy towels, nice bath, etc. And they checked in 2 hours before the attack started, and they're in their room getting ready to go out for dinner. In fact, they'd already been out, and they'd had a drink at the Leopold Cafe, which was also shot at. So they'd missed that, and then they'd come back in and they were getting ready to have dinner in the restaurant when they suddenly started hearing gunfire, and they're in their room. And Will said that he'd turned to his girlfriend and said, what the hell, this is a 5-star hotel. What, I can't believe there's gunfire going on inside the hotel. To cut a long story short, they were then stuck in their room for about 6 or 7 hours. And like most other people who were stuck in their rooms, they just had no idea what to do because they could just hear gunfire. They could hear people being executed in rooms along the corridor from them because the gunman went systematically through the floors and shot people.
Presumably, they're watching it on the news as well.
No, because the electricity's gone off. Then there was no communication from the hotel, so no phone calls.
So they've got no idea.
No idea.
Just four guys
texting his parent, his father back in London, and her mother were the only bits of information that they could glean. And the worst thing is, so they're looking through the spy hole of the room door, and all they can see is like they can see gunmen sort of flitting around. They can start to see flames. They can hear the sound of people being killed. And outside the window at the front of the hotel, there's absolutely nothing. So there's no emergency services, there's no flashing lights, nothing. The heroes are not coming to get them. And Will said by 3 o'clock in the morning, so what, 5 hours in, he just said they'd had enough. They just thought, no one is going to come and rescue us. We have to just get out of here under our own means. And so they tied all their sheets of their bed together and curtains and stuff, chucked it over the balcony of the window of the room. And he said, I'll go first. She said, I don't think this is a very good idea. He said, well, it's our only option. And so he went over the side of the balcony, started climbing down the rope. It broke. He fell to the ground. She thought he was dead. And she found him the next afternoon, in Bombay Hospital, and he'd broken his spine. So he's now in a wheelchair for the rest of his life, cursing the day that he decided to jump out, because there was help on the way, and if they had waited a bit longer, then they would have been rescued by firefighters. But when you're in the middle of it, you don't know. So, I mean, his life has been completely and utterly transformed as a result of that one night of luxury they had in the hotel.
Not that many men, a few dinghies, some fairly basic weapons and explosives, some technology, but a lot of which is available free with a good internet connection. Do you think we'll see, well, we have just seen one attack like this in Nairobi, but do you think we'll see more attacks like this in the future?
Definitely, because as you say, it's inexpensive, high tech, in that you use what's available sort of from social media and also communications. I think it is definitely the way of the future, because it's a very easy way to mount terrorism. It doesn't involve kind of armies, it doesn't involve millions of pounds, it just involves a bit of imagination. I think the lesson of Mumbai and of the Westgate siege is to think the unimaginable.
That was the Vice podcast with Adrian Levy and Cathy Scott-Clark, whose book The Siege is out now and is a great read. Thank you for watching.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.